Okay, a few. There are a few remaining questions about the class structure, class location problem. One was exactly how I think about managers now. So first, one little preliminary. Nothing I say, of course, should be treated as authoritative. Given that my positions evolve and whatever, they are. As I've said, they're contributions to an ongoing conversation about how to think about locating people in a complex class structure. So in the current version, there are two primary things that are going on. There is a way of identifying privileges with respect to exploitation. So exploitation remains a problem. Some people are exploited, some are exploiters, and some have privileged positions within exploitation, where privilege means they have a capacity to reduce their own exploitation. That takes the form of a rent in their wages, and there are different ways that can happen. So that's a stratification idea, a privilege within a relation of exploitation. And there are contradictory class locations in terms of the original version, which has to do with being simultaneously in more than one class. So managers occupy a contradictory location within the domination aspect of class relations. They are both capitalists and workers with respect to domination. They are both dominated and dominating. And they occupy a privileged position with respect to exploitation relations. Those two things come together for managers. Skilled workers occupy a privileged position within exploitation relations, but they don't occupy a contradictory location within domination relations. It's one of the reasons why credentialed labor is more likely to be politically aligned with workers than managers are, because they are less closely bound up and aligned with the capitalist class, because of they're not as bound up in these interlocking relations of domination. Yeah.
I mean, the reason I asked is just, I'm thinking, granted it has to do a little bit with the idea of false consciousness, but Malcolm X brings up that analogy between the house slave and the field slave, and how the house slave, when the master's house burns down, the field slave says, his house burning down, versus the house slave says, master, our house is burning down. And just, it seems as if managers were kind of within that, granted rhetorical, formulation would fit in that idea of kind of of the house slave, of not really realizing that they're being exploited by the capitalist class.
All right, so I think the way to just tweak that to make the metaphor a little richer is to distinguish between the foreman, you know, the kind of lower level manager who's more like the house slave, and the upper manager moving towards the CEO, which is more like the Mamluk. You know, in the Ottoman Empire, there were slaves who were the rulers of countries. The Mamluks were slaves of the Ottoman emperor, but they were also the rulers of countries. So they were kind of this kind of privileged caste of slaves that were so deeply connected to the centers of power that they were trusted delegates of power. You know, so that wasn't the case for black slaves in the United States. Although there were some slaves, first of all, there were black slave owners in parts of the South, particularly in Louisiana. So there are those peculiar circumstances. There were also slaves who were the slave drivers. And that is the slaves who were in charge of punishing and controlling slaves and who had lots of privileges within some plantations. So then it's getting more like this, more complicated situation. Paula asked a question about stock ownership. If you only own a little bit of stock, how does that change your class position? Well, I think this becomes then a gradational issue. Right. If you just own stock, if you own a little bit of stock, it means there's just a tiny little bit of contradictory edge in your class position. I think workers, ordinary, you know, industrial workers who have some stock, know they have some stock, it makes them think about their relationship to capitalism differently than if they didn't own any stock. So it does have effects on their self-understanding. But it's also real, because a little bit of their economic future and interests now depends upon what's going to happen with their own portfolio. If it's trivial and small and makes very little difference, it's not going to have much of an effect on their strategies and location and relationships to other workers. As it gets bigger, it has a bigger effect. But then the question is, does it actually bring with it any of the powers of ownership? Are they somehow not really owners just because they own the stock? Do they really not have any of the powers of ownership? Here, I think it's important to really understand how the powers of ownership work in a capitalist economy. And the analogy, I think, is very much to the way the powers of voting works in a representative democracy. So it's never the case that any individual voter decides big elections, right? So even, you know, even the 2000 election wasn't decided by any individual voter. The margins were extremely thin. Occasionally in city council elections, you know, there'll be an election that's decided by one vote. But it is the case that all elections are decided by the collective vote of individual voters, even though no individual voter decides elections. If you own a small amount of stock and you buy and sell stocks depending upon how well that stock is, how well stocks are doing, so that when a company looks like it's going to be doing well, you buy that stock, and if it, you and your broker or your financial manager or whoever is, or your mutual fund even, whoever you've delegated this responsibility to, sells the stock when they think it's going to do badly, what you're doing is contributing your votes to the disciplining of firms, which has real effects on what firms do. So one of the ways that power is exercised in a capitalist economy over the behavior of firms, where they're going to invest, how much they're going to try to innovate, how they're going to treat their workers, one of the ways that happens is through the stock market, the rise and fall of stock prices. And prices only rise and fall because people buy and sell stocks. And people buy and sell stocks only because they own stocks. And if you own a little, then you're participating in that exercise of power. So it's really not the case that even if you're a completely passive investor and you've given it over to a mutual fund to do it for you, it's really not the case that you're not part of the social relations within which power is being exercised over capitalist firms. You are, in the same way pretty much, you know, the analogy isn't perfect, but it's good enough, I think, that as an individual voter, when you go out and vote, you know if you have your eyes open that you're not going to decide the election. And yet, you also know that power with respect to who wins depends upon what you're doing, you and everyone else. You're participating in the exercise of power even though you don't individually have power. And that's really the way to think about the ownership and power thing with respect to just owning stock. Just owning stock is really exercising power, in the same way that owning the franchise is really exercising power. When you exercise that power, that is, when you go to the ballot box. And just as in the electoral democracy case, where we might say, yes, but direct democracy, where you have workers' councils and you have neighborhood councils to decide local planning and you have all this more elaborate form of direct participation, just as that would represent a stronger form of individual participation in the exercise of power over the state, one would say the same thing about a capitalist economy, that if it was worker co-ops rather than a stock market, and if there were community banks that were run by stakeholders rather than by shareholders, yes, that would be a way in which ordinary people could have more power over the behavior of firms. I don't think it follows, though, from that the passive ownership of just owning stock means that it isn't real ownership. It is real ownership. And it does really change the nature of the class structure. And it's part of the complexity of the current situation that I think is understated. The emphasis around wealth distribution in the United States has been correct, I mean, understandably, on how much more unequal the wealth distribution is on the one hand than the income distribution, and how much worse the inequalities in wealth have become in recent years. Both of those things are true, and yet it's also true that a much higher proportion of the American population owns stock today than 50 years ago. And in that higher proportion, there's a non-trivial part of it that own enough for it to matter, you know, for it to be part of their understanding of how they're positioned in the world. I haven't looked at the data recently, but my guess is that I think the figures are that somewhere around 45% of Americans own some stock. The top 1% owns more than the bottom 80%, but about 45% own something. And my guess is probably the top 20, 25% own enough to matter, is my guess. You know, I mean, that would be a good little project. If somebody wanted to do a little mini project on that for the class structure paper, you know, the next short paper, that would be a perfectly, it'd be an easy thing to get the data on. You know, it wouldn't take a lot of Googling to track down the data. To look at the distribution of stock ownership by income decile. That's what you'd want to do. You'd want to look at income deciles of the population and the stock ownership wealth by income deciles in 1970 and 2010, so to speak, and see how far down you have to go before stock ownership amounts to, you know, some significant amount, however you want to define that. And that would be a way of talking about complexity in the class structure. Any other follow-ups from the end of the complexity of class structure? Yeah.
So what will you define like semi-auto employees in the contradiction club?
Yes, so I remain ambivalent about the semi-autonomous employee idea. I mostly have shifted to thinking about professionals as privileged with respect to the exploitation problem. They have this privileged status within exploitation relations. And high-paid professionals add to that capitalization of their income. You know, they become partially capitalists by virtue of their ownership of portfolios. Yet it is still true that their control over their own labor process, their own activities is an important thing. Just thinking about my own life, I would give up one hell of a lot of income to maintain my autonomy. I mean, the thing about my work life that I value most is my autonomy, which is essentially nirvana as far as I can tell. There's almost nothing I do that I don't want to do. You know, it's really absurd. And the things I don't want to do, I do out of conviction, not out of job constraints. So I don't want to grade prelims. You know, one of the worst things I have to do is grade prelim exams. But I definitely feel I'm not doing it because I'm required to by the job. I'm doing it because I'm part of a community where I value graduate education and feel that responsible, you know, certification and monitoring is needed, and I would be a scumbag if I wouldn't do it. So, I'm in this unbelievably privileged position with respect to the autonomy issue. And because it's so salient to me, it's hard for me not to think of this as part of my location within the relations of production, right? So I do think the autonomy issue is salient, but I haven't really been able to give it more precision than I did in that earlier work. I don't like it being thought of as combining petty bourgeois and worker positions, because that's a sort of backward-looking way of thinking about it rather than a forward way of looking at it. The kind of autonomy I have is the sort of autonomy that should be characteristic of people's work lives, rather than the petty bourgeoisie, which is this old artisanal position, you know, sort of situation, which is a vestige of an earlier era of economic development. And that didn't kind of ring right. I don't live in a world of, it's not simple commodity production. It's you know, it's more post-capitalist production that I'm able to get a snatch a piece of through my work setting rather than pre-capitalist work relations. So I don't have a good way of giving class precision to that idea. And it, yeah, Stephen.
Can we think about managers as a kind of piece worker in which the piece that they're producing is a rate of exploitation in which is revealed through profit, materialized as profit, and that they're paid a portion of that profit in order to create the incentive for their alignment with capitalism?
Well, it's not piecework because the pieces aren't identifiable in terms of the income that the pieces generate from which they get a piece back, right? So I don't think I don't think that captures it. They are engaged in activity which is organic to the production of profit, and their loyalty rents, which is what I call them, are, you know, paid for out of the surplus that the firm generates. That's transparent when it's in the form of bonuses. It's implicit when it's in the form of high earnings.
So the organization that, here's one of the moves, conceptual moves that I'm a little unclear on, and what really brought it home was the table where you look at the difference between what's owned in capitalism socialism. It seems to me that corporations do own the organization of a firm, that the organization that is above and organizes the labor process in a capitalist firm is separate than the basic material means of production, but it's essential for producing commodities, and that is actually owned by capitalists, and that organizational asset is what these higher paid workers are tapping into, right? It's their power within that organizational asset that gives them this rent. But rent, to me, implies at least a counterfactual of a market process, which I don't see brought back into the theory.
So the counterfactual to the loyalty rent is the democratic workplace, not a market process. That is, you ask, what would be the income of managers if we had an egalitarian distribution within the firm of the control rights over your organizational activities? So
that's domination.
But that's what the organizational assets really are. So it's the organizational assets are the control over the allocation of tasks and activities within the firm, which is also so in that 1985 book where I introduced organizational assets as a way of talking about this, I was trying to create nice symmetry between capital assets, skill assets, and organizational assets. And to see each of these as being unequally distributed so that I could talk about them in the same way. And then for each of them say, what would be the conditions of life for people if they were equally distributed? And that would be the Romer-type test of whether people were exploited within those kinds of assets. So I was using the term asset, probably misusing the term asset, in order to create terminological symmetry across these three dimensions, capital, skills, and organization. In fact, what I meant by organizational assets is just authority. It's just the power relations of domination within a firm. Really, there really wasn't anything else I was talking about. I was just relabeling it organizational assets in order to create this kind of symmetry across the three categories. And I think that was a stretch to use the term asset. The distinction between owning it and controlling it with respect to organizational assets, you know, I think you're right that the firms are owned by capital, so all things in the firms are owned, including these relational assets of that we call organizational assets. But what it means to own them rather than just use them wasn't very clear. So I in the end, I don't think that terminological use was that productive.
I guess in thinking about it in terms of what the organization adds, I'm moving in the direction of thinking that the organization actually does produce value, additional surplus value, that you know, if you had the same material means of production, one with a better organization and one with a less better or suboptimal organization, that organization produces more surplus value, and that could be conceptualized as the value produced by those dominating workers, that their work in domination is to produce additional surplus value, which we, you know, at least conceptually think of as what they contribute, and then that value is then somehow split up between them and capitalists, but that requires for me some sort of market, you know, counterfactual at least. I guess that's why I was thinking that you could potentially conceive of it as a kind of piecework, or that the incentive structure is not just a loyalty based for domination, but an alignment of class interest relative to exploitation.
Right, but I don't think those are distinct in this context. The problem is, how do you get managers to have their behavior aligned with those of the owners of the firm so that they would do what the owner of the firm would do if the owner of the firm was the manager, but for efficiency reasons, the owner of the firm wants to delegate that to someone else? How do you get them to do it? That's the problem. The reason it's a problem is because they have power over the allocation of tasks and activities and the monitoring of other people and various kinds of strategic decisions, all these things that are packaged under this organizational assets idea, but which are equally well packaged under domination or authority. I mean, each of those describes what it is that they are able to do and damage the firm if they don't do well. So I don't, and it is certainly the case that there are social technologies of production, not just physical technologies of production, of which organization is one, but communication systems could be another. How you run meetings could be an example. There's good and bad ways to have meetings run at different levels of a firm, and the bad ways create rivalries and dysfunction, and the good ways create free flow of ideas. So there's all sorts of aspects of how you organize production on the social dimensions that affect productivity and thus surplus, and in which employers want their managers to do well, and which they have a problem because of the delegation of power. And that's where I think the loyalty rent idea comes in. But I don't think it requires that the rent part of it be somehow partitioned from just the value added of the organization, as opposed to there's a pool of surplus that gets allocated to different purposes, one of which is ensuring the loyalty of managers.
Yeah, I guess I'm still wrestling broadly with the concept of exploitation and having that counterfactual there or some way to say this is what this, you know, worker or manager ought to get, right, based on
right.
Value.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to. Presumably, most managers are themselves still net contributors to the surplus of the firm. That is, that's still the principle of employers, is that they don't want to pay managers more than what the manager contributes to the firm. That principle dissolves when you get to the very top of management, which reflects the fact that the very top levels aren't really managers. They're part of the ownership structure of the firm and are able to directly appropriate part of the surplus for their own purposes. You know, so you get golden parachutes to incompetent CEOs who have destroyed a firm, but they still get paid huge bonuses. There's no way you can describe that as a rent salary to assure their loyalty. It's a different mechanism altogether. All right. Look, I think...